All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? I don't know what's going on. Well, I probably know what's going on, but I am not reacting to it directly because I recorded this a few days ago before I left for a vacation. So this is at least a little emotionally dated. I have no idea what's happened in the last few days. That's not true. I probably have an idea, but I'm not reacting to it either emotionally or literally, because if I was, I would be able to see the future. And generally, when I think I see the future, it's not good. Well, so maybe I could speculate then. Maybe I could possibly paint a picture from my imagination that might sync right up with what happened since I recorded this on last Saturday. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say, what am I going to say? I hope I'm having a good time. Well, you know what? Why not be optimistic? I'm having a great time. Maybe I'll pretend like it. Fuck, another week. Oh, God, I don't know how we're going to get through this shit. What a fucking, wow, just try to keep your, I don't know, man. It's weird when everything you do that is your life and that might bring you some enjoyment just feels like you're holding off the inevitable or avoiding something that requires immediate and horrifying attention. That's not good. Let's just stick with I'm on vacation. I'm having a nice time, as nice as I can. I haven't had a vacation in a long time, so I'm trying it out. I'm trying to get my head straight, trying to breathe some air, look at some pretty, sleep some sleep, write some things down, fortify my heart and mind, that kind of stuff. Okay, all right. So I don't know what's happened. I'm not responding to what's happened in the last few days because I recorded this a while ago so I could go on vacation without recording out there. I forgot to mention who's on the show, what's happening. There's several guests actually on the show today. It's funny, when I read the Blue Apron copy, it reminds me of my character in the Mitch Hedberg movie Los Enchiladas that apparently is not available anywhere to anyone. But I think you can probably see it somewhere. It's got to be out there. I played the menu writer. It's a little close. It's a little close when I read the Blue Apron copy there. It reminds me of that character. That's a long time ago, making Mitch Hedberg's movie. I got that lovely box set recently of the Hedberg stuff on vinyl. It's great. Today on the show, a couple of guests. Right now, I'm going to have John Hodgman and Jesse Thorne. They are part of the Very, Very Funny Day, a one-day podcasting festival in Chicago on Saturday, February 11th, with live performances of Judge John Hodgman, Jordan Jesse Go, The Flop House, Stop Podcasting Yourself, and more. You can go to MaximumFun.org for tickets. And after John and Jesse, I talked to the aggravated Joe DeRosa, comedian I've known for a few years. I've never just had the time to get him in here. It was good to talk to Joe. I feel like we're kind of kindred spirits. So that's a pretty loaded show for a vacation week. Let's go now. This is me talking to John Hodgman and Jesse Thorne here in the garage. You would think I would have gotten a new situation, fellas, right, Jesse? I mean, you helped me set up this situation.
Almost. It's a nice situation, though.
We're
ensconced, particularly when the weather's cool. Ensconced in your piles and piles of books.
Right, but I think about it myself sometimes. I'm like, do I have to have that headphone amp just dangling off the side of another piece of equipment that I rarely use?
Well, I like that you have this Radio Shack telephone handset here.
Right. Yeah. I definitely
have. Sweet landline.
That's my sweet landline. That is the, exactly. It's a Radio Shack landline. And that other thing under it is a Telos Do you know those from your radio activity?
I got a Telos.
You got one at the house?
I was just on my Telos earlier today.
But isn't, like, that is a piece of rack radio equipment that you use to record phone calls with.
Yeah.
Now, I have to assume that there is a technologically easier way, but no one's told me one. I mean, is there another?
Just use that Telos, baby.
That's right. I think
we're transitioning to Telos.
Yeah, we're switching over to Telos. We've been trying to do it technological ways. It never works right.
So is that
we're
true?
Back to phone lines. Yeah.
Is that both of you?
Yeah, for Judge John Hodgman, because John records in Brooklyn and I record in L.A., we have guests in a studio somewhere.
Oh.
And so, like, we're just sick of Skype failing.
Noise.
Yeah. Oh, right. The sound quality's not there, right? And you don't want to get an ISDN line, I'm guessing.
Well, you can't even get an ISDN line anymore.
Is that true?
Yeah, they won't put one in for you anymore.
I had one in here briefly that I never used years ago. So that shit is over.
Yeah.
Why? Because they're moving towards a new technology?
No, just because it was mostly used for, you know, the theory was that it was a high-speed internet connection.
Yeah.
And so, but it's not high-speed relative to any other high-speed internet connection in this time. And the number of people who want to use it for broadcasting is about 10 in each city.
I thought it was a satellite connection.
What we need is some hipsters to start up an artisanal retro ISDN system.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, then you need the whole other piece of equipment that delivers the ISDN. That's a whole other piece of equipment.
You got to get that duplexer.
Yeah, that you got to plug the ISDN outlet into and then run it into the mixer. Like that piece of equipment, which I had briefly, is actually confusing and difficult.
Yeah, it sure is. It's got like a number pad on it. And you have to type in secret codes.
Yeah.
I just want to say how much I appreciate, Mark, you're making eye contact with me during this portion of the conversation because I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Thanks for trying to keep me involved and presuming that I know
very little.
But as Jesse will attest,
I thought
my situation, Jesse might have kidded out your situation.
Yes.
How does this compare to my situation, Jesse?
Yours is a little rough.
Yeah, right?
We're working on it.
What's the problem with my situation?
Well, John records his whole thing in his office, right?
Right.
But for some reason, John...
I have a stark minimalist aesthetic.
You'd think with the volume of books that John has, or just the volume of books that John has written, there would be book-lined walls and, you know, you would imagine John's office, like with
bearskin
rugs, carpets.
Yeah, on the ceiling.
With club
things.
Chairs.
Yeah.
No, just four bare walls.
Yeah.
One of which is literally a mirror. He records into a window.
Yeah.
With one of these mics, though?
It sounds like it actually...
I just got one of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds... And no matter what he does, it sounds sort of like that one reverb room under Capitol Records.
Oh. You got to put some of this stuff up.
Yeah, I got to get some foamy foams.
Yeah, I got some rugs.
I got a nice cozy rug coming.
Oh, there you go.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, you can stick some of these panels around. Yeah. The original panels.
I lined all the walls with ceramic plates.
No, wrong choice. I don't know. Yeah. Which book did you read in?
Like old vintage plates like you see in a diner sometimes.
We should put in that kind of like those adjustable audio reflectors that make that change the tone from classical to jazz.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'll go with that.
So, John, both of you guys, I've known you for a few years, and neither one of you had the amount of hair coming out of your faces. Jesse seems to have really committed. He's transitioned from what I would think was sort of somewhat of a dandy into a hill person.
I am wearing like a chore jacket right now.
And John, I don't know what stage of evolving evolving from into?
You know, I grew a mustache about 5 years ago.
I remember.
And
I was jealous. I'm like, he's doing my thing.
I was inadvertently doing you. I didn't mean to be copying you, but I definitely was.
Once your soul patch comes into play, that's just me
mustache,
and Zap and Leon Redbone. That's it.
That's right. Mustache without soul patch, though, gets very quickly into alcoholic cop.
Oh, yeah, right. So
So the mustache was easy to explain because that was just, I grew that the same reason all 40-year-old weird dads grow their mustache. It's a signal to the biological mating community. I'm all done.
Is it?
Yeah.
We've wrapped this up.
Yeah, that's right. No, thank you.
I don't know.
Mustache rides priceless.
I have put my genetic material out into the world. I am no longer required.
I thought that was usually a weight gain thing. I find that the mustache may not be putting that message out into the world. But I'm not you. But I generally thought that when you want to signal that, you just forget that you can't eat everything.
Well, right. Exactly. And then I decided to grow this beard.
Yeah.
because I just felt compelled to see what would come out of my face. Because I think everyone wants to know what kind of secret lives inside of him.
How much do I got?
Yeah. And what I learned, the secret man who lives inside of me apparently is the part-time bookkeeper at the Church of Satan.
You're a little thin on the sides, but full on the chin.
Yeah. I got a lot. I am a natural born neckbeard, y'all.
Natural born.
This is all mine. I don't have any neckbeard weaves in.
Well, that does say I'm done. The neckbeard.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. But Jesse has been cultivating something. Jesse's
got a magnificent.
At first, even when I started seeing his new Twitter avatar, I was like, you know, he's in. And this is what he's doing now. This is if someone goes, what's Jesse up to? I imagine he's working on his beard and mustache.
Do you know what the honest truth is, Mark? I've wanted to have a beard since I can remember.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. I presumed I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I figured out that I sort of could, and like my beard in terms of fullness.
It's a real goddamn Horatio Alger story.
It's a B minus, you know, like it's not the greatest beard.
Well, no, you don't have dense hair, but you've grown it out.
Yes. Yeah. And essentially I figured by the time I got my beard, it was on the downward trend.
Yeah.
I was like 7 out of 10 with 10 being so over you can't do it. Right. I figured if I'm going to do it, I better do it.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Like I can't half do it.
Right.
No 5 o'clock shadows.
Sure.
Like I have to have a full on crazy person's beard to show, yes, I know what it is.
Right.
I know where it is on the trend, but I'm going to do it.
Well, but knowing you and knowing that, you know, you have probably a sock weave preference. There's a certain, you know, shoe products involved that perhaps I was just thinking that the products that you've researched and figured out what to do for yourself has got to be, you know, very exciting. So what kind of products are you working into that fucking moss on your face?
You have to use mustache wax, not because you want to like have a curly Q mustache, but because otherwise if your mustache is longer than your lip, you are constantly eating your mustache.
See, I was just about to mention that there's almost an optical illusion going on because your beard is thinner than it seems.
Yes.
But the mustache tricks you into thinking it is this full luxurious thing, because I'm looking at you from the side profile here and I'm noticing once again, and I've noticed before, that your mustache seems to grow like out at a 90 degree angle from your lip.
Yeah.
And is like reaching out like alien tendrils in Star Trek The Next Generation.
That's the wax.
Yeah, and keep it under control.
Whereas my mustache, if I were to grow it as long as yours, because those are long hairs under your nostrils, they would just immediately go directly into my mouth and then try to strangle me from within. Just grab my uvula and in an Ouroboros type of way, consume myself.
Yeah, you got to train it. You got to wax it and train it.
Very, complicated and elaborate poetry. We had the Ouroboros reference.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Ouroboros is the snake that eats its own tail.
Yes.
What I call a really dumb snake.
Sure. And also a fine metaphor for the world we're living in.
True enough.
Yes, that I think the Ouroboros was created as an alchemical symbol of some kind, wasn't it? Or does it go further back?
I thought that it was a reference to Jormungandr, the world snake that surrounded the Midgard in Norse mythology, the snake around the earth.
I think it's one of those odd symbols that existed for some reason in many ancient cultures.
It's very compelling, isn't it, to think that there's a snake out there that's so dumb it's going to eat its own tail.
Yeah, well, as far as you know, when you look at the evolution of the thoughts around the idea of sinning and whatnot, you know, on a very simplistic, primitive level, that could be every fucking mistake you make.
Yeah, that's right. You are. It reminds us that we're all dumb, dumb snakes.
Exactly.
That are causing our own pain.
Don't do this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have a tail anymore. I cut that off at birth.
Right, yeah. Well, I don't know what I'm eating.
Yeah.
So
I just want to promise your listeners at some point I am going to cough and it is going to be disgusting.
Because
I am under the weather.
Yeah.
But I am naturally an aging, decrepit human being.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners to the Judge John Hodgman podcast will know if they've ever heard me cough that everyone goes, oh my God, are you all right?
Well, that's like an old judge should have that. Exactly.
Now let's see what we have here in front of us today.
Yeah, as you dispense justice, you should hear that you are not long.
That's right. Yeah, yes, that's right.
Like, not forgive my ignorance, but you just produced it, or part of it?
He's my bailiff.
Okay,
so you remember the announcer?
You remember the People's Court?
Yeah, sure.
back or Judge Judy. Mm-hmm. They have a bailiff or night court.
Aren't they still on?
Yeah, of course.
Night Court. I just had John Larroquette in here.
Did you really?
Wonderful conversation.
Sorry, I will continue to do that. That was the best slap pace in network television.
Yeah, a lot of people go to Seinfeld for that, but you're going to have to go back to Night Court.
Oh yeah, Night Court was there long before
and had a good run.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Shout out to Mel Torme.
Like 9 years that thing was on.
It's a good show.
So if I were Judge Harry in Night Court, Jesse would be my bailiff bull.
Yeah, or Roz.
I get how it works.
Yeah,
and that's the structure show, and people are enjoying it.
Yeah, people call in with real disputes.
Yeah.
And then Jesse swears them in, and then I walk them through their disputes, which are usually about things like, what, Jesse? I can never remember.
Oh, my favorite one was a fight between two brothers who bought a house in rural Kansas.
Yeah.
Known forever as the Bat Brothers, because the house bought in rural Kansas, you can buy a house to save money.
Yeah.
And they bought this house together to save money. But the problem with the house was bats kept getting into the house through one of the bathroom walls.
Oh, my God.
Due to a hole.
Yeah. And so the dispute was, one of the brothers said, we have to fix this hole. Bats are getting in.
Yeah.
Then the other brother, who was like completely taciturn, like a total Kansas Eeyore guy.
Yeah.
He's like, we bought this house to save money. I'm not going to spend $1,500 fixing a bat hole. And so
his recommendation was, his bat amelioration scheme was to keep a dictionary by his bed.
Right.
And if he saw a bat, smash it with a dictionary.
It was a two-part system, John.
Sorry.
I hate to correct you here.
I apologize.
But his two-part system was, number one, there would always be a phone book next to the toilet.
Right.
So that if a bat got into the bathroom, you could smash it, and they would always keep the bathroom door closed so that the bathroom would be like a bat airlock.
It would be bat isolation chamber.
And this is a real...
Yeah, and it was 100% real.
What do you do, one issue per show?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'll hear both sides of the thing, and then I'll say, what you really got to do is have a reality show.
Right.
In that case.
Did they fix the hole?
No, they sold the house, I think.
No, they had. I think they eventually sold the house, but they had to have a jar into which they put, it was like $10 or $20 every time a bat got into the house. And were that jar to fill, were required to patch up the hole the money.
That was pretty wise of me.
You're a very wise man, John.
The problem is that I forget my wisdom immediately as I move on to new justice.
I've been using that case as an example of what happens on Judge John Hodgman for like 5 years because it's the only one I remember.
Isn't there a big plan? Aren't you guys doing an Abbott and Costello shtick? Or are you doing a...
Well, we've been touring Judge John Hodgman, which is super fun.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's fun... For me, because people like Judge John Hodgman, unlike any of my other shows, so they come to live shows. And then, it's fun because we get to yell at these people in real life.
So you pull them right up out of the audience. You get people to fill out things.
People submit cases,
right?
Just like they do for the podcast, but they submit them specifically to be heard on stage.
Right.
In wherever we're going to do it. And the next one we're doing is in Chicago on February 11th.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is going to be like a 12-hour, it's called Very, Very Fun Day, and it's going to be like a 12-hour Maximum Fun podcast and some Chicago podcasts extravaganza.
What venue?
Multiple rooms.
Thalia Hall.
Okay.
Do you know that place?
I do. I feel like I know that place.
It used to be an opera house that was shuttered for years and years and years. Then some nice young men with beards came and turned it into an art space.
Oh. Yeah.
That's good.
I feel like I've been there. The last couple of times I've been there, I played the Vic.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great theater.
Yeah.
But I feel like one of the festivals use Thalia Hall?
That could be.
Recently?
Yeah, that could be.
I feel that might be it. So there's many.
It's been open for maybe a couple of years.
Many spaces within it?
Yeah, there's a main theater space,
right,
which is gorgeous.
What are we talking, 800-seater?
25,000 seats.
That's big.
I think probably something along that. No, I bet
the Bulls played there for Bulls played there for a while, but there weren't enough luxury boxes.
Yeah, it's too old fashioned.
Yeah, and they all had red velvet curtains. Yeah.
Then they got like a restaurant in there, and then they got a lounge in the basement where they play some smooth jazz.
Yeah, we've got big podcasts. It's going to be us and the Flop House, Jordan Jesse Go. Ross
and
Carrie.
Of you. That's two Jesse Thorne podcasts.
Well, it's cheaper. It's more efficient that way.
Are you doing a Bullseye there, too?
No, we're not doing Bullseye there.
Bullseye's your secret public radio treasure.
Oh, well, it's secret in the sense that no one listens to it, yes.
What do you mean no one listens to Bullseye?
It's the least successful show on National Public Radio, if that's what you mean by secret.
He checks the rankings every day.
I remember when you, what was the old show on public radio?
It's Sound of Young America.
The Sound of Young America was one of those ones where, I think I've told you this story before, where, you know, I did that dumb thing with you in Santa Cruz when you were in college.
Like, when he says dumb thing, John, I don't know if you know this, but one of the first time, maybe it was the second time I interviewed Mark, Jordan and I, who does Jordan Jesse Go with me, were still in college.
Yeah.
And it was a fundraising show, and we were doing it from the base of the UC Santa Cruz campus where you have to drive past to get in.
Yeah.
In our underpants.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Mark was on the phone.
Yeah.
God bless him.
But I did it, and then years later, I'm in Astoria, Queens, you know, making some coffee in my kitchen, and I hear NPR at night, and it's like...
live from my living room. Yeah, I'm Jesse Thorne.
Jesse Thorne. I'm like, is that fucking kid?
Yeah.
And it was in his underwear that, he did all right for himself, that guy.
I met Jesse because I was a guest on The Sound of Young America, too.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being told...
I wasn't a guest. I was on some radio college thing.
Right. Well, this was after you had graduated from college,
but I was
right?
still living in San Francisco. I mean, we're looking at, it was 2004 or 5.
It was 2005 because it was from a first book.
Yeah.
The areas of my expertise.
And it was before you were a celebrity.
That's right.
It was on the eve of your celebrity.
Celebrity eve.
And what happened?
Well, my publicist said, do you have time for one more phoner? And I think it was near Christmas and I was up in the woods of New England with my family. I'm like, well, okay. He said, this is a woman named Jesse Thorne. She has a podcast. And she has a podcast called The Sound of Young America that is also syndicated in Walla Walla, Washington and Hattiesburg, Mississippi on radio.
Shout out to WUSM.
I said, okay.
Sounds good.
And if you've ever heard the voice of Jesse Thorne and you have been hearing it, it is a beautiful and compelling radio-licious voice.
Yeah.
But imagine if you had been told this was a woman's voice.
Oh.
It was a very
it's hosted
confounding,
by the great Nina Simone.
Yeah, it was a very confounding phone call to have, but I was immediately struck by the intelligence and preparation behind this strange
man-woman
voice with perfect radio diction who has only heard in Hattiesburg and Walla Walla. And that
was the beginning of a beautiful relationship.
I mean, I literally...
Look where we are now.
Well, now look...
Mark, I booked John on the show on the basis of, this is like a funny McSweeney's guy. Like, I'd seen his McSweeney's things.
Oh, yeah. Is that still around?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And I booked him on there, and he was so funny on the show. I mean, maybe still the funniest guest that had ever been on the show. And my wife and I went out to his book reading. It was like a week later in the Hate in San Francisco. And literally the crowd at his book reading, for which he had brought his and our friend Jonathan Colton dressed in buckskins.
And a coonskin hat.
Literal buckskins.
Jonathan, who plays guitar and is my, I'll say definitely one of my better friends.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to say best friend because...
Yeah, I've met him a couple times.
I'm from New England and I'm an emotionally stunted human, but... I was scared to go on the road by myself, so he came along with me, and the gig was that I would pretend that Jonathan was my feral mountain man butler.
Ah. Yeah. So he had a built-in shtick.
John is trying to do his shtick with poor Jonathan dressed up in this outfit, and the crowd at this is the people that work at the bookstore.
Yes.
Me, my wife, my now wife, then girlfriend, Teresa.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
A man who had driven John there.
That guy.
Oh, Frank Loria. Yeah.
And
shout out to Frank.
I forgot.
And
about
Dave
Frank.
Eggers and Dave Eggers' baby.
Yeah. Good crowd. Good crowd. And a buckskin man.
Just Colton just walks out for his big entrance in his buckskins. You just see him. I mean, he's the nicest man on earth and brilliantly talented and hilarious. And he just walks out and he's like, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wearing the buckskins for these people. Yeah.
And Edgar's baby cries.
Yeah. There were one or two other people there, but that's basically correct. I mean, literally like one or two. And the reason I say that is that I was reading a bit from my book describing the old street con, the three-card Monty.
Sure.
Now, you know what the three-card Monty
is.
Sure. But it's disappeared because there is...
What is it? Watch the Red.
Yeah.
It has not disappeared. I saw someone doing it the other day.
Where?
In downtown Los Angeles.
Stop really? It. Good for you.
And I also saw someone selling... Tiny Turtles, which was like a staple of my mother's, another staple of my mother's childhood.
Living Tiny Turtles?
Living. Yeah, Living Tiny Turtles.
Right.
Are they doing retro street crime?
Is that no.
Retro street scams?
There's just, Los Angeles is so sprawling that there's just parts that have never advanced beyond 1963.
They still haven't, didn't get around
three card,
to
the three card is right. There's the guy with the cards and there's the guy pretending to bet money that's talking you into betting money and there might be one other shill there and then there's a couple guys watching for cops.
Exactly.
And I wanted to give, when I saw the guy actually doing it, I wanted to give him $5 in the same way that you would support someone who is keeping clogging alive.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. A lost art form. Good for you, sir.
Yeah.
But when we were, this was a thing like in our 20s, we would see in New York.
Right.
And I fell for it.
When I did too.
Yeah. And my wife.
Never see $20 my wife go never more
fell,
quickly.
My wife never fell for it, but she saw it one time and her friend said, oh, that's three card Monty. And she's and my wife was not my wife at the time. She goes, how do you know his name is Monty? So adorable.
But he got that guy pressuring you, like, you know, like, I think I lost like $20 or $50.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's like, come on, come on.
And come on.
They're bullying you to put your money down.
Right.
And then you don't, a lot of times they'll kick the thing out and split because a cop or whatever.
Right.
Like, you know, right when you can't even get the opportunity, not that you would win it back.
Yeah, no, don't, Mark, you're not missing any opportunities there.
There's no winning?
No, there's no winning.
God
oh,
damn
Mark.
It.
But I had been taken so hard and so humiliatingly, anyway, that I wrote a jokey bit about it in my book, and I'm reading it in San Francisco, and I'm not getting any response.
Yeah, because they don't know what it is.
And I said, is it that you don't have three-card Monty here? Or everyone in San Francisco is just so virtuous that they would never con one another. And someone in the audience said, that's what it is.
Everyone.
All right, listener, here it comes.
Are you? How many books have you written, John?
Three books, and I'm about to write a fourth book.
Really? What's this one about?
So for the past couple of years since I wrote my last book of fake facts and bogus trivia and goofball absurdist humor,
No one knows the difference anymore,
I know,
apparently.
Well, that's why I realized I couldn't peddle it anymore. Well, I literally couldn't do, you know, I basically stopped being on The Daily Show because the character I was doing, the deranged millionaire, had been based on Donald Trump. It had been based on 2011 when Donald Trump was going on CNN and Fox and everything else peddling the birther conspiracy.
Right.
And I said to The Daily Show, that's what we should have.
Yeah.
You know, like
that guy,
just a rich white guy who gets to be on the news because he decides to be.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I said, let's turn my character into that. And they're like, okay, let's do that. And then once Donald Trump became a reality, going into 2015, when Trevor Noah took over the show and we were talking about, would you like to stay on it? I'd like to, but I need to think about what to do.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing I can do. I can't compete with the long form improv that guy's doing. Like, there's no, you know, everything that I've ever done comedically.
The high risk, dangerous improv of the incoming administration.
Yeah, right. Well, at that time, it was just an absurd campaign.
Yeah.
It was nowhere near
the
horrible reality.
Yeah.
In my opinion, horrible.
Right.
I don't know where you guys stand.
I'll stand there with you.
I'm an NPR journalist. I have no opinion.
No, Jesse has no opinion.
Yeah.
So I basically said, I'm out, you know, because my humor in that vein had always been like, take this and then take it to
the next level,
its logical conclusion, and then take it to its illogical conclusion.
Right.
And its absurdist conclusion. But Trump was already doing that and then going beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So for the past couple of years, instead, I've been traveling around doing Judge John Hodgman and then also doing my one-man imitation stand-up comedy show, which is just more or less straightforward storytelling from my actual life.
And does well? You do well with that?
I do incredibly well.
Oh, good.
25,000 seats at Thalia Hall.
Yeah, yeah.
100,000 seats.
I hear you playing 25,000 theaters everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Everywhere.
He's got actually doing six in a row in Dublin.
Oh.
625,000. They love country music there, so he's very big.
The O2 Arena in London.
Yeah.
That's a great town, Dublin. I just played there, too, not too long ago. I really liked it.
I've never been to Dublin or Ireland.
Ireland is one of the most beautiful places on the planet.
Yeah.
It's, and like, I have no genetic connection to it, but I get there and I'm like, this is beautifully. I feel like I could be home.
You get it right
away.
You
just switch the O in my A and the A in my name. You get Moran.
Yeah, right.
Be a quick switch.
Yep.
And I fit right in. But
you're thinking about it, aren't you?
Even when I went there, when I went to the Kilkenny Festival, I did not do well there. But I was so taken by the country itself and the landscape and the people. I just felt so
Mark, you know what your natural there. You know what your natural home in Ireland is?
What?
Belfast.
Yeah.
Get out of Dublin, get into Belfast. My stepmother is from Belfast.
Yeah.
Who I grew up with.
Yeah.
And that's your people, Mark.
Really?
Belfast is a land of just profound bitterness and bitter hilarity.
Well, like, okay,
the
all right.
Darkest, they will go to the darkest place in a half a second.
Well, I find that a lot of Irish will do that, but not. I don't sense bitterness. I like the slightly defeated crankiness.
Yeah,
that like you know like aggressive darkness. I get it. It's exhausting me now. I moved through the bitterness, and now I'm sort of like, where's some of the warm kind of like the cranky darkness, slightly defeated, that kind of ends existentially pleasant. You know, like right. that you're moving towards something, and it's okay at the end.
My
wow. You have really dissected the Irish character.
It's true.
My Uncle John,
yeah.
My wife and I went and had lunch with him when I was in Belfast last, which was maybe 5 years ago. And we met him in this nice cafe, this nice organic cafe, you know, like a real tofu and bean sprouts sandwich. Uh-huh. And I'm looking around and I'm thinking like, man, there sure are a lot of pictures of like Yasser Arafat on the walls here at this organic cafe that my uncle has had us meet at. And apparently he had us meet in this cafe that is like a socialist revolutionary cafe underneath Sinn Féin headquarters that used to be IRA headquarters because that's like where he's most comfortable. My uncle is like a 60-year-old like guy that runs the computers in an office.
Uh-huh.
But like his comfort zone is there has
radical.
To be
he wants to be in the radical
socialist.
There has
to be the presence at any time of possible
social
murder
overthrow.
And murderous violence. Yeah. Like, and that to him is the funny, like my stepmother, funniest story that she'll ever tell you is, oh yeah, one time a police officer tried to sexually assault me and I kicked him in the nuts and then I kicked him in the face down a flight of stairs. Ha ha ha.
That's the Thanksgiving story?
Yes.
At the table, kids?
Well,
listen up, grandma's going to say something.
It sounds like they are probably the best equipped people for the next 4 years that we know.
Literally the Thanksgiving story, Mark. They only got meat once a week.
Yeah.
And because my stepmother's father died when she was very young. She grew up very poor in a big family.
And they had to eat him?
And her sister, yeah.
But only once a week. They had to parse him out over many, many weeks.
Each kid got one rasher of bacon for Sunday dinner.
One ration of rashers?
One ration of rashers.
Yeah.
And my stepmother's sister tried to steal her rasher of bacon.
Yeah.
And my stepmother, who's the youngest in the family, who was like 8 or 10,
yeah,
stabbed her sister through the hand with a fork.
Huh. For the bacon.
For that one piece of bacon.
To protect the bacon.
To protect that
one piece
of bacon.
See, these are Belfast Irish stories. They're a little too heavy for me.
Yeah. I thought you wanted to go to
where's the existentially uplifting
darkness?
You want
to focus on like a potato famine, something that's more of 100 years in the past.
Potato famine,
than
20. Like, you know, well, you know, we get by.
A dark imagining, but with a little affirmation at the end.
I've still got the Max Fun patch up there pinned to the bulletin board.
Oh,
from the one time I was invited.
The time that you said I was the benevolent colonel of the nerd plantation. Yeah, that was the best description I had ever had until I. Have you ever had Tom Arnold on your show?
Yes.
Tom Arnold's kind of an amazing guy.
Yeah, you get 2 for 1 with him.
Yeah.
At the pace he goes.
he came on Bullseye and said that I looked like the bouncer at a Hasidic strip club.
Oh, there you go.
That was the new. That surpassed.
That's I don't know if it surpasses in depth.
Of that. That's true. That's fair.
So, all right. So we're promoting the Chicago thing.
Yeah, we're going to have some tickets at the door. I mean, we're going to try and do it over the summer. I mean, if you're not in Chicago, you can listen to the podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Of course.
Yeah.
But the big event at the Thalia, you got a lot of seats to sell, 25,000.
25. I think there are about 24,000 left.
Wow.
Yeah. So advanced tickets are sold out, but we're going to have some tickets at the
door.
Is that true?
Yeah, totally.
Well, then why the fuck am I here? Bye.
Exactly. He's sick.
Sorry.
You drag him out. from Brooklyn to
so,
do this?
So sorry.
Well, thanks for talking, fellas. What?
Thank you.
You have a closing message?
Ladies and gentlemen.
If it please the jury.
Have fun, you guys.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Those fellas, huh? Right? Go to MaximumFun.org for tickets to the thing, the very, very fun day that they're involved with. And, you know, that's it. That's it for those dudes. All right, so I'm going to talk to Joe DeRosa now. Joe DeRosa, I met in New York. I used to see him around. He was on the show years ago on a live one. You can go to JoeDeRosaComedy.com for Joe's specials and podcasts and all things Joe. This is me and the mildly self-involved and tormented Joe DeRosa. DeRosa.
Buddy. Been a while.
Has been. The last time I think I saw you, we had a conversation about whether or not we were wearing shorts or capri pants. And who cut their fucking jeans properly. We were both very proud that we made our own cutoffs.
Yes.
But mine went up a little higher than yours, and then there I saw the flurry of insecurity in you as to whether or not I was right, you were right, and you decided, I think, in your heart, that you'd make the right call by cutting yours off just above the knee.
See, and I thought mine were too short, and yours were even shorter.
Well, yours were not. How were they too short? If yours were any longer, they'd be capri pants.
Mine, above the... capris go, you got, like, some space above the ankle with a capri. Then you right. got, then there's clam, remember clam diggers? That's not the same thing as capri pants. That's like a little higher than capri pants.
Clam diggers, man, I don't know, maybe I missed that. Maybe I missed clam diggers.
You weren't
know.
Into shorts back in the day?
Sure I was, but like I remember I did cargo shorts for a while just because they were easy and you bought them everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe many years ago, I had a couple of pairs of tennis shorts when I might have played a little tennis. But cutoffs have always been sort of the thing I did. I've had longer shorts.
I like a longer short, so I think I could have been a little longer without being at a capri pant. I threw those shorts away.
Really?
I wore them that one day, and I never wore them ever again.
What happened?
I just was too self. It didn't feel right to me. It didn't
really
feel right. Yours looked good, even though they were a little shorter than I would wear them.
Yeah.
You wore them well.
Right.
And you had a great line, by the way. I said I cut mine off this morning, and you said, so did I. And I go, how'd you do yours? And you go, I brought in a team. Because I was just like, there was like this whole science to it. Like, how do you, when you're not living with somebody, how do you cut your own shorts off?
Yeah, you mentioned this right when we got in about not wanting to be alone. What are you all right?
I guess so, yeah, yeah.
I mean, what do you mean living with somebody? You mean like a woman?
Yeah, yeah, a woman.
Or just a dude that you're like, dude, did these shorts, can you come over? And
sometimes that would come in handy.
Sure.
You know, just to have a person
a person to say, that those are good, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. I look at
good
it as...
Good job, Joe.
It's a consultant, no matter how. It's a roommate, wife.
Am I okay?
Way.
You're okay, Joe.
Yes. Can you come over and do that for me? I've been a living alone for most of my adult life. So I'm 39. I'm getting to the age where I'm like, did I run out of time here? What? I feel like I should have been in a significant relationship by now.
By 39?
Yeah, my longest relationship was 8 months, and I'm like, it should have been longer than that by now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Are you panicking?
Yeah, especially when you go, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I've been in longer relationships. They don't usually end up successful.
Right.
So, these are two sides of a coin here. You haven't had a long one you think you should have. I have had plenty that just ended up in the toilet.
But I would say that yours falls on the side of better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all.
Or better to have thought you have loved and left to wonder whether you're even capable of it and lost.
Are you in a relationship now?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you get to live out in this great neighborhood, because that's what I was saying to you was, well, I mean, you get to live out here either way.
Yeah.
But I said to you when I first showed up.
Yeah.
I love this neighborhood. If I wasn't so terrified of being alone, I would live out here.
Well, yeah, but I had that thing. How long you lived out here?
A little over 3 years.
From New York.
Yeah.
The first couple of years I lived here, I lived over by the old UCB up on Franklin.
Right.
So there's about two blocks of walking traffic.
Right.
Like there's storefronts.
Right, yeah.
I think that when you come from New York, there's a natural desire to be able to walk outside, mm-hmm. walk to a store, walk to the, but you're by Atwater Village,
yeah.
So you can walk by there, maybe wave at the guy at the place.
Right, right. You buy a pastry. Yeah, exactly.
Right, how you doing today? Fine.
Exactly.
And then, you know, go try to think you're not alone for a little while.
It's an illusion. It's a holodeck. It's just a holodeck.
Well, it's illusion in the sense that, you know, L.A. is fundamentally, you know, not that kind of city. And it is hard. It's a hard adjustment to make. But look, if having those four blocks of useless fucking stores and restaurants enables you to feel comfortable.
It does. It does. It really does.
I'm not going to take that away from you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's going to diminish.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me have my little thing.
Like, where do you go in the morning? Like, you get up and you're like, okay, here are my rounds.
Well, I have a dog, so I get up, I walk my dog. I try to do like an hour walk with the dog first thing.
Really? Like a strenuous or?
Not a strenuous, just it gets him exercise. It gets me out. I'm walking around. It gets the juices going. You think. You're right. Whatever. Then I come back and I do a mile on the treadmill.
Yeah.
Just to
wear it, the house,
sweat it out. I have a gym in my building that I live in.
You live in a building that has a gym.
Yeah.
In Atwater.
Uh huh.
So you have a full service apartment situation. You're not renting a house or anything.
No. I'm renting an apartment with all the amenities.
So you did. That's another nice natural adjustment from New York.
It is very
nice. If you rented a house like most people do, you'd be like, I can't. There's nothing. You'd be sleeping on the floor, wondering who fixes things when they break.
I rented a house when I first got here, and I would call the landlord and be like, hey, so these filters are clogged in the air conditioners? And they'd be like, yeah. And I was like, so come. And they were like, no, you go and you do it. And I go, so then I'll just take it out of the rent? And they were like, no, it's a house. You just... So
try owning one. It's a disaster. Because I'm the same way. And because of that, things have to get pretty bad around here for me to make changes. What were we talking about? You're sad and alone.
Sad and alone. We can go back. Let's circle back to that. I mean, I feel like that's a thing that you and I could talk about for a very, very long time. We'll blow through.
I haven't been alone in a long time. And I don't know sometimes whether or not I stay in relationships or I'm in them, you know, because I'd rather not be alone.
I wish I had that problem because I do the opposite. I'm terrified of being alone, yet I run. I don't know if I've ever shared this with anybody. When I start to approach a commitment.
A commitment of any kind?
I'd say an intimate, romantic commitment, mostly.
Okay.
Because I don't have a problem making friends, you know, and all that stuff. But a lot of the time when I approach an intimate thing.
Are they really your friends, though, Joe?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's more like this.
Yeah, comic friends.
It's comic friends.
You all right? I'm all right.
Yeah.
All right. Good to see you. That was funny.
This is. I want to tell a quick story about you.
You can go eat. You want to eat? What?
The first time I saw you, this was years ago.
Right.
So you were not dating the person you're dating now. I don't know who you were dating. But
it wasn't good.
I saw you at the Improv. It was the first time I saw you
here,
after I
moved
to LA. Yeah.
Oh.
And. The last time I'd seen you was in New York. We did Opie and Anthony together. And as I was leaving, you said, hey, man, if you ever need a place to stay, you call me, dude. You're a good guy. I got your back. And I was like, that's really nice. And I knew I would never ask you for that favor. But
me
it,
too.
It,
me-
it meant a lot. It was comforting just to hear it. So then I saw you at the Improv.
Yeah.
And I had a place to live and everything. I just was feeling down and I wasn't really adapting to LA.
Yeah.
And I walked up to you and I was like, hey, man, how you doing? Just moved out here finally. What's going on with you? And you just went, relationships are hard. And then you walked away.
That was it?
That was the whole conversation.
Well, at least I wasn't mean to you.
No, you weren't mean. It was just
you and I always got along. I you know, I was always surprised. I think initially I was surprised because, you know, you have an Italian name. Joe DeRosa,
right.
You cut your hair kind of bro-y, you're a little metro-y at first,
right.
And like I always, you know, before I knew you, I kind of lumped you in, not with guys I didn't like or guys I didn't think were funny, but guys who I thought were the opposite of me.
Right.
So when I met you and actually hung out with you, it was a revelation that somebody who looked like you could be as insecure and fucking nutty You know, like you were like you were a portal into the reality that people who look like they're from Philly can be fucked up, insecure guys.
Yeah, yeah. No, that I get that a lot from people.
You do?
I get it constantly. People are like, you have this, you give off this initial first impression that you're maybe a little like meatheady or something.
Right.
Or abrasive or whatever. And a lot of that's got to do with my comedy, because my comedy is not very uplifting. But it's not
mean, and it's not like narrow-minded. It's introspective and kind of hard on yourself.
Yeah, it's a lot of what the fuck is wrong with everybody.
And me.
More everybody.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, but it's becoming more about everybody else.
Maybe we're getting to the real thing then.
Yeah, maybe we're getting here. Let's get to the real thing.
Really?
Yeah, but I'm serious. I get this all the time. People go, you're like a nice, sensitive guy. You're really emotional.
Yeah.
I cry at stuff all the time. And
yeah? Yeah. What was the last time you cried at?
I got a little teary watching the finale of Sherlock the other night.
Oh, really? I didn't watch that. I don't know where people find time or the shows. What is that show? Where's it on?
It's on. I was catching it on the PBS app. The new season was being released on Masterpiece Theater on the PBS app.
Yeah.
Which is the only time I've ever watched Masterpiece Theater.
Right.
Was because I could get the new season of Sherlock.
Right.
But I love the show. It's great. But I get teary. I'll cry out of elation.
Yeah.
You know, like when I saw The Force Awakens, the second to last Star Wars movie, I cried when like Han Solo came back on the screen out of like nostalgia and elation.
Sure, no, I get that. I mean, I tear up pretty frequently. I've watched some movies lately where I teared up. I tear up at certain points during an AA pitch, certain people's stories.
Yeah,
I cry. I don't watch many commercials anymore because I'm not watching a lot of regular TV. But I definitely get moved. Yeah. All right, so we cry. I get it.
Yeah, we cry.
Okay.
Age of Innocence.
Well, but where'd you grow up? Are you a Philly guy?
I was born in Philly.
Yeah.
And then I grew up outside of Philly in a small town called Collegeville, or Trap was the other name of it,
which,
ironically. But I grew up in a suburban town that was very, I have no ill will towards my hometown. It's where I grew up. I have a lot of love for it. But it was a very...
What's it called, the town?
Trap.
T-R-A-P-P. How far out of Philly was it?
Not far. 20 miles or something.
Okay, so you're like, but Philly was your city.
Yeah, Philly was my city. Norristown, Pennsylvania, King of Prussia, you know. Yeah.
How old are you?
39.
Where'd you start doing comedy? In Philly?
In Philly. I started in an all-black club called The Laugh House in Philadelphia. I was one of two white comedians.
Who was the other guy, Big J?
Jay had already moved on. Jay started there with Kevin Hart.
Right.
And Kurt Metzger, and they all moved out of Philly about a year or two before I started.
Right.
And then I started, it was Mike Vecchione was the other white, and then there was another guy, Rocco Stowe.
I know Mike Vecchione.
Yeah.
And who, Rocco who?
Rocco Stowe or Brian Stowe. He's at the store sometimes. You've probably met him and
Into
him. Yeah. He's the guy you thought I was. Like, he is...
Oh, yeah?
I'm not saying that as a slight. I love the guy. But he is very Philly. He's very like, so what are we doing, huh? What are we doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He's very much that guy. But he's a great dude. He's hilarious.
Why are you not that guy?
Because I'm damaged. I'm broken. I was adopted.
You were adopted?
Yeah, I'm adopted.
Wait, now, okay. So how many siblings do you have?
None. My parents couldn't have kids. My mom wanted to have 6 kids. That was her dream. She couldn't conceive.
Uh-huh.
She got pregnant once and had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And then they adopted me. And the way they they're religious people. And the way they adopted
Catholic?
Me. Catholic? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Catholic. Roman Catholic. And the way they adopted me was, by some people's interpretations, would have had a miracle.
Element?
Element to it. Like, so what happened was
you have no parents?
I have no parents.
You just appeared?
Yeah, there was no father.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was an immaculate conception.
Wow.
No, my parents were on two different adoption lists. They were on a secular list and a church list. And the church list called my parents and said, you have to remove yourself from all other lists if you want to remain on our list. And my parents said, we're not doing that. And the church said, well, if you don't, then you're going to have to take yourself off our list. And they said, well, we're not removing ourselves from any other lists. And the next day, the secular list called them and they got me. So my mom saw that as a miracle, that had they listened to the church at that moment, they wouldn't have gotten me.
It's a miracle in the wrong direction.
I know it is. It's, yeah, you see where I'm fucked up now, is they're telling you it's a miracle, but then it's not a miracle because it's a miracle against the church.
Yeah, the church wanted you to turn your back on the possibility of Joe.
Yeah. So that was the beginning.
Were you newborn?
I was like 9 days old.
Really?
And I never remember being told I was adopted. I always knew. So they told me from an early age, I mean.
And what'd your dad do? What was the family business? What'd you grow up in?
My dad worked in computers and later became a deacon of the Catholic Church.
Really?
That's what he does now.
Yeah. He's a deacon. Now, where is that in the hierarchy?
It's one step below priest.
One step below priest.
Yeah, and he has told me if my mom dies, he would probably become a priest.
Wow. So a deacon, though, did he make enough money in the computer racket to not worry about that, or did they get pretty good pay?
No. They used him and chucked him out after 40 years or something like that. They laid him off after 40 years with nothing. He had to work at Home Depot until his retirement, whatever, kicked in.
Really?
Yeah. We were real paycheck to paycheck growing up. We didn't have a lot of money, but my parents, it was like typical 80s trap bullshit. They bought the house that was out of their price range out in the suburbs,
right,
and got into all this credit card debt, and their jobs let them down, and
What'd your mom do?
Just administrative stuff. She was a secretary, mostly, here and there.
But they really were into the church.
They still are.
Yeah.
They still are. My dad is very religious, but not in a Bible thumper way. Like, he has said in defense of me, you need to find your own way. This was my way. It doesn't mean it's your way. He's very righteous in that sense, which is refreshing.
Yeah.
He's a pretty...
So you didn't get it. You didn't get it laid on you, the hell thing? And
I did in school and stuff. But as I got older, that sentiment got a lot more reasonable.
Do you remember the moment where you decided, like, this isn't for me?
From the beginning, I never...
Because, like, I talk to Catholics, and sometimes, like, some people are lapsed, but other people are, like, early on, they're like, no,
it
not
never,
buying it.
Yeah, it never moved me. I was terrified of it, because I did believe, because I was a kid, so I believed in the supernatural idea of there's a pit of fire you'll burn in, or whatever.
Right.
But it never moved me. I never enjoyed church. I was always stomping my feet, having to go to church. I was also depressed from a very young age. My neighborhood where I grew up, the environment I grew up in, was very cookie cutter. It was very uninspiring. There was no diverse culture or anything there.
Yeah.
And I knew from a very young age, I'm talking third grade, like, I got to get the fuck out of this place.
Really?
Like, I got to get the fuck out
You're
of this place.
You're ready to go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, and I just knew that it was going to be so long until I could do that. And that made me terribly, terribly depressed.
Well, in yourself, in your introspection, what do you think the being adopted, what does that imply to you? I mean, have you ever tried to find?
No.
No desire?
No desire. No. Huh. I pretty much took the hint when they abandoned me.
Oh, see? Now you can hold on to that.
That's an old bit.
Yeah.
To take you through it properly, it meant nothing to me in the beginning. I didn't think it didn't bother
Being
me.
Being adopted.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it. I didn't care. Then when I was 12, my mom broke the news to me that I was not Italian.
Right.
By blood. I was actually... what I found out later, Middle Eastern, but she thought I was Egyptian because that's what the adoption people told her.
Yeah.
That one of my parents was Egyptian.
Uh-huh.
So I found out that I wasn't what I had thought I was for 12 years.
Italian.
Yeah.
So you can pass.
I can pass. Yeah, it's good enough. So that was like a sort of a cage rattle at that point in my life, and it kind of fucked me up a little bit.
It's kind of exotic, though. Exciting. You might be half Egyptian.
My mom's, I love my mom dearly. I don't say this to criticize her, and I know she was trying to protect me, but my mom said to me at that time, don't tell anybody, because we lived in a sort of, there were a lot of racist people where we lived, and she didn't want, and she was so, because of this thing where they wanted all these kids, they couldn't have the kids.
Yeah.
Then they had this miracle, in quotes, adoption.
Yeah.
It becomes like a sort of a smothering situation. She was overprotective. She was so terrified she was going to lose me. To the point of giving me advice in hindsight, which wasn't great, which was don't tell people what you are ethnically, because they might...
After you found out at 12.
Yeah, they might harm you. And I was also getting bullied a lot in school at that time. I don't know. I just was. Probably because I wasn't the Guido meathead that you wanted me to be.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know.
But how overprotective was your mother?
Overprotective in the sense that she said, don't tell anybody you're Egyptian, because why add fuel to this fire? But not overprotective when I would cry and say, please switch me to another school. She said, no, you have to face your battles. You can't leave.
Uh-huh.
So,
you don't remember why you were bullied? You were just one of those guys?
I had one of those faces. Yeah, you know, I don't know. Were you bullied as a kid?
I don't know. I don't think so. Not really. I think as a young kid, no, I probably tended towards the other side. I might have not been the main bully, but I might have been one of the kids behind him going, yeah, fuck that guy.
Congrats. You're the first comedian I've ever met that was on that side of it. Every comedian's always on the other side of it.
I was always odd and always outside of things, but I think that I had a certain amount of... I remember, I never quite felt like I fit my own skin or fit in anywhere. So I would attach myself to people, you know, uh-huh. and they weren't really bullies, but I definitely always felt alone in the crowd. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But I was never really majorly bullied.
Well, I think we all, meaning comedians, because I hate that shit where it's like, you know, us comic. But I think people that don't fit in all feel like that, and obviously. And then we all react to survive in our own way.
I would probably disagree with you. You may not have met any comedians that were bullies, but I think there's a few out there.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I was just being facetious.
Right,
but yeah. No, I could name a few.
Yeah, they're still doing it.
It's a great point, actually. Now a lot have really come to mind, and I retract the statement.
You know, I'm sure we all felt odd and uncomfortable, or that we didn't fit in. That's usually what I hear.
Well, I think people that feel odd and uncomfortable, take it out of the context of comics, just people in general that feel like that. I think you survive in your own way.
That's right, and I think that it's true. If you are putting that out in the world, you know, you're vulnerable.
Yes.
Like, you know, some people can't hide their vulnerability, and I guess that's what you were saying.
Yeah, I kind of steered into the curve and was like, well, why puff my chest out when I could just curl up in a ball over here?
Sure.
You know what I mean? And that at a young age, because in all fairness, I was kind of a mama's boy because I was raised with such
fear.
Yeah.
She was afraid.
Yes.
You know, it's weird. Great. Like a lot of times, I just thought of something that was very sad. Like, here's how I was bullied. If I was bullied, it was this way. And this is unique, and you might be able to relate to this, because I think we have something in common. I'm not sure what. But temperament.
Yeah.
But, like, I would work really hard to become part of a group of friends. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say, like, those guys are cool. So I would do everything I could to ingratiate myself or find a way in to hang out with them. You know, I was not naturally charming. I was not the guy that everybody wanted to hang out with. Right. I was the guy kind of like, I need to... hang out with those people.
Right.
So a couple of times, like once I finally kind of pushed myself into the social situation, they would treat me like an asshole.
Really?
Right. Like, you know, like when I finally made these friends, like I you know, I really wanted to be friends with this guy, Dave. And, you know, once we started to become friends, you know, we would make plans and he wouldn't show up. That kind of shit.
Okay. Well, that's interesting, because when I got into high school, and my high school started in ninth grade.
Yeah.
When I went, I immediately became friends with all the baddest kids I could find. Like,
right.
I became friends with all the
like jail yard thinking.
Yeah. Like I became friends, and they were all like the hip hop kids, with the puffy starter jacket, trench coats and all that stuff.
Right.
And I loved hip hop, so that was fine by me.
Right.
But those are all the kids I hung out with. And same thing. At first, it was great. I got in and they really liked me, whatever. And then I became the run of the litter. And then I was the guy that they fucked with all the time.
Yeah, I was sort of that guy, too.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
And then what ultimately happened with me is I just found my own way. Like, you know, like that was high school. And then when I started hanging out down by the university and I got a job down by the university and started to meet like people that were, you know, way above and beyond you know, what was interesting to people in high school. And I started focusing on art and talking to the guy who worked at the bookstore. Like, I realized there was another world out there and I didn't have to be tethered to, you know, drinking and driving every Friday and Saturday with a bunch of wackos.
See, I didn't fully discover the other world until college.
Yeah.
I did eventually make real friends in high school, and I did eventually have a nice time.
What was your thing in high school?
Music.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I played music.
What'd you play?
Well, I started out playing drum. Well, I played saxophone in grade school. Then I switched to drums in high school.
Yeah.
And then I started playing in bands, I guess, in 11th grade or something.
Yeah.
So by the time I got to 12th grade, I had a couple bands, and people thought
drummer?
That was cool. Yeah.
One
of them I drummed in, one I sang in.
Oh, yeah? You sing?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm, you know, that implies being paid to do it. But no, I can sing.
Like what?
Like rock, you know, indie rock.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Like, what songs were you covering back then?
We weren't really covering songs.
You were writing your own music?
Yeah, we were doing...
You were writing songs?
Yeah, we were writing songs.
You wrote some songs?
I still write some songs.
Really?
Yeah, I do like...
Are they sad?
Logic. If you listen to the lyrics, they are, but on the surface, they sound pretty fun.
So you're at home in Atwater with your dog writing sad songs? Do you ever stop on the treadmill to write down a lyric?
Yeah, yeah. I got to hit pause on the workout. That's we're all running, but there's no end in sight. Where's the finish line?
Wow, it's really shaping up.
Yeah.
To be a fine portrait of you.
I haven't done it much lately, but...
With the songwriting?
Yeah, I just, you know, I still do it as a hobby. I put the stuff out once in a while, but it's nothing that, like, I pursue. But I did it one time. I thought that's what I was going to do, and the reason I started doing comedy was because I got tired of... I was always a fan of comedy, but I got tired of having to cooperate with three or four other guys and get everybody on the same page, and I wanted
The band.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to express myself more easily.
Right.
So I thought I can go up on stage without lugging drums everywhere.
But, all right, so you had your music guys in high school. You found your way into an indie rock band.
Right. Yeah, or hardcore. It was hardcore music at the time.
Hardcore?
Yeah. Like a lot of screamy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like punk?
Like post-punk, post-hardcore stuff.
Okay.
Like bands like Quicksand and Into Another, and so it's screamy and singy. It's a little bit of both.
So you're screaming and singing.
Screaming and singing, you know?
Isn't that just...
Much like now.
Yeah, that's the core of what you are. So did your band... Were you popular, or did you...
No, we were... It was...
What, did you have four songs in a rehearsal space?
We had 10 songs. Yeah. We had enough to play like a half hour set, and we would go and do shows and nobody would show up. And then sometimes we'd get on a decent show at like some kind of punk house in Philly somewhere, and there'd be a bunch of bands and you'd meet some girls and drink some beers and whatever. But it was fun. But it was typical when you're at that age.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, we got to make it, man. It's the band. And then all my band members quit, and then I was like, oh, okay, I'm the only idiot thinking this has a chance. So then I joined another band, and then I started to back away from that band and get a lot of shit from those members.
Yeah.
So then I was that guy, and that's when I started to be like, you know what? Fuck this, man. Like, I just want to be alone, and I don't know how to play guitar.
Right.
So I better figure out another way to get on stage by myself.
Really? That was it? You had no real passion for the comedy, necessarily? I mean...
I did have passion for it.
Did you know comics? Had you seen live comedy?
I was an avid fan of comedy.
Yeah.
Avid fan. And I had a huge passion for it. But my passion was for the expression side of it. It was never... I never got off back then as a fan... I used to love laughing at it, and I enjoyed that. But I never got off at the idea of getting on stage and making people laugh. I got off on the idea of getting on stage and expressing yourself. It was Carlin that made me want to do it. When I was 12 years old, I saw Carlin, and that's what planted
the seed. That's funny, because that's another thing we have in common. Yeah, I never thought of myself as an entertainer. I thought, well, I'm going to get up there and figure out who I am.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I first started, my dad pulled me aside and he goes, "How's the comedy going?" And I go, "It's good. It's good. It's hard, but it's good." And he goes, "Are you getting something out of it therapeutically?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Good." And that was the whole conversation. So he knew. He was like, "You need some kind of..."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's weird, because if they, you know, then if we have that in common, there was some sort of like lack of sense of self
in our
I had a hard time. Like, I played some music and stuff, but like I said, I was the guy that was trying to be friends with the people. You know, I was the guy that felt outside of everything. Like, I get it. I have a feeling like, you know, and I've tracked it to how I was brought up. But I mean, I think as I entered life and got older, you know, I just didn't have a cap on my personality.
Right.
And I needed to sort of like, you know, own some space.
Right. Right.
Somehow.
Well, I've always had that problem.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was an identity crisis. My manager said to me very recently, stop, because I slip into it still. She said to me recently, she goes, don't try to think of the thing you need to do that's going to make everything okay. Think about the thing you just want to do. Because I'll still sometimes slip in and I go, well, what if we did this? And then that could lead to, you know? Yeah. And she's like, don't think like that.
Well,
like,
I do. Here's how I phrase it. And I say this a lot. I just got to figure out.
Yeah.
My buddy Jerry's always like, yeah, maybe you don't have to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I gotta figure it out.
I think that's a common trait with guys like us, is we think that it's a puzzle to figure out, which goes back to the.
Well, I mean, I'd like to think that I'm working on a puzzle, but really, I just think that I'm, you know, like, I don't feel right, so I gotta figure something out. You know?
Yeah.
It's like I don't have the foresight to see the puzzle. It's just like in a moment, I'm like, I got to fucking figure this shit out.
Then do you ever, like, does it ever, are there moments where that works for you, that approach?
I don't know, man. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of things have worked out that I didn't think were going to work out. And, you know, there are some things that, you know, I'm not as worried about as I used to be.
Right.
But, you know, I find a lot of it is just has to do with kind of like, you know, if you're kind of trying to figure things out and always pushing and pushing and pushing. I don't know if that I take enough time to be grateful. I don't know if I take enough time to, you know, like, I'm constantly moving through bits. Like when I perform, like, I don't like to know exactly what I'm doing.
Right.
You know, I like to, you know, so. There, I still am. I don't think I'm addicted to the adrenaline of that, but I like. It takes a lot for me to get out of my head and into the present. And the things that I do innately to do that, which is like improvise on stage or do what we're doing right now, are very sustaining to me, because they get me out of my head. Mm-hmm. But once, you know, if I spend too much time in the head, you know, all bets are off, and I got to figure some shit out.
I'll get way in my head and. I'll make decisions where it's like, what were you thinking? You know what I mean? Like, I'll be running. I'm trying to get this set ready to hopefully do a late night show. And I had to record it a bunch.
Yeah.
And I was recording it at a bunch of shows last night. And they were all pretty small shows. So I had good recordings of it, but they were small crowd recordings.
Right.
You could just hear that the jokes were working.
Yeah.
And I finally end up at a show at the Improv. It's packed. It's sold out. And I go, all right, this is the show where I'm really going to get it. You know what? I'm going to change the opener.
Yeah.
I'm going to change the first. And I go up, I do the, and it doesn't work. And I'm just like, fucking idiot.
Yeah.
Why? Because I got in my head. I was like, wait a minute. This is what I've been doing wrong on. It's like, you weren't doing anything wrong.
Right. Did the rest of it work?
I bailed out of it.
You bailed out of the new set.
Yeah. Because I was like, I'll just send one of the other recordings. That's it. Like, I bailed out of it. I told the audience I was trying to record a set. I'm not doing that anymore. I don't feel like doing this, so, like, let's just do jokes, other jokes.
Yeah, see, why'd you see, like, I've done that in my life, but what, you know, like, what was it set for?
I'm trying to get onto Conan to promote this special that I have coming out.
Right.
Yeah, so, well, you know, so hopefully it works, but they needed to hear the set as a set, so I recorded it, but I was recording it, and I got a good recording of it, but it was in front of
video?
No, they just wanted an audio to hear the flow of it. And I got a good recording in front of a small crowd. But then I thought I can get a recording in front of a big crowd. And then there's nothing to worry about. Again, the puzzle.
Yeah.
If I just do this, it'll be perfect.
And you bailed after the first joke.
Got the first joke didn't hit. And I was like, well, I can't send them a set where the first joke doesn't hit.
And it's
hit.
Packed over there.
And it's also a different joke than I've been talking to them about.
Right.
It's this joke they've never heard.
Yeah.
Because I got in my stupid head.
It's fucking nuts, those 4.5 minute sets.
It's so hard, man. It's so, I got it down to 5:30. That was as, I don't know how to make it any shorter.
Yeah.
I'm just like, can you guys just cut? Just tell me what to do, please.
But well, they can. That's usually who you work with over there, JP?
Yeah, but I've never done the show, so I'm hoping to do it for the first time.
Oh, you got to do that show. Why not?
I hope so. Oh. I've never really done late night.
Really?
I did Pete's show when I was working over there, Pete Holmes' show.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I did Carson Daly years ago, but I've never done like proper...
Big credits.
Fuck off. I have other credits that are good. I just don't have good late night credits. Yeah, I gotta get a proper late night credit on. I don't need to. I just would like to.
It's fun to do Conan. I think I've only done panel over there. I haven't done one of those 4.5 minute jobs in a few years. Quite a few years. I tried to get into the panel situation as much as possible.
See, I want to get. How many years did it take before you got to do a panel? Because I said last night to somebody, I said I feel like I'm cut more from the Jim Jefferies, Stanhope. Marin, you know, you,
sure. Thanks for throwing me in.
No, I'm just the only the only reason I didn't is because I didn't want you to think I was comparing myself to any
right,
of
right.
you, and it was particularly embarrassing because I'm sitting across from
right.
you.
I get it,
but I have a great respect for you.
I appreciate that.
You sound like you do. The
what do you want me to say?
I don't
do
know.
Do you? Do you, Joe?
Thank you.
Yeah.
But like I always related more to guys like you than the guys that write succinct, quick jokes, whatever.
Don't you envy them though?
I do envy them.
God
but
damn
you,
it!
You guys all went right to panel. You guys never did like sets. Really,
I did sets.
When did you do sets?
I did 4 of those fucking sets on Letterman over 2 decades.
Right.
I did early on with Conan. Conan's really where it started. You know, I did stand-up sets on Evening at the Improv, Jon Stewart's show. I did stand-up sets on Caroline's Comedy. Like, I did a lot of those.
Well, I did a lot of those things.
Yeah.
But I just haven't done proper...
Well, when 4.5 minutes, like, it's such a bad representation of me. And there's a couple Letterman sets that I did. You know, they were very spaced out, but they were great. And they didn't fucking make any difference
right.
at all.
Right.
And it wasn't until, you know, I got one panel shot with him, and it was like a highlight of my life.
Yeah, I saw that. It was great.
Yeah, and it, you know, and it was just with Conan, like when he started in New York, I did the show probably the first or the second year in. I did 2 stand-up spots, and I was in town, and I, you know, and then I said to Frank Smiley, I'm like, can we do a panel spot and maybe do a bit on the panel? You know, mm-hmm. like I think one of my first times on panel, I did a shtick. Like we had a plan. I think it was might have been the John Lennon thing. Like where I would, you know, we'd produce a bit. Where we'd throw to something,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then I just became a panel guest because it was just easier for me because it also was situational in that I was in town, and they knew I'd built a dynamic with him, so if they had a fallout or someone could make it, they'd be like, well, maybe Marin has got something, because a lot of the times on the Conan's panels, those bits aren't even finished,
right.
but they were funny enough,
right?
You know, to have a conversation
sure.
with.
Sure, and that's the best way to do it, I think.
It is, but what's funny is, and this happened to me later, is like, even my manager was like, well, maybe you ought to remind people you're a comic. Because when you're doing panel and people don't know you, they still don't know you. Like, you know, most of the time when someone's doing panel, they're people are like, oh, that's the guy from the thing. He's just talking.
Sure, sure, sure.
But if you're a comic, there's an argument to be made that you should establish yourself as that.
I just, it's that 4.5 minutes is so hard. It's so hard. As in straight stand-up, I mean, as you've already
said. Well, let me ask you about that, though, because with me, with these joke things, like, I can write a joke, and sometimes they happen naturally, and I'm very aware when something I've written is just what you're talking about, guys
right.
who do jokes.
Right.
I mean, it's my joke, but it is a joke, and I can feel when they happen.
Right.
But, like, you know, once I do them a few times, I'm like, all right. I guess that one's done.
Yeah.
Whereas as opposed to something that's part of a longer conversation or exploratory or has room in it.
Well, that's what happens to me is, for some reason, the only short jokes I ever write are horribly inappropriate for television ever. I don't know why. I can't think of any one-liner or short thing that isn't offensive in some way. So that never happens. And then what happens is when I try to do one of these, put one of these sets together. So JP and I went through... sweeping sections of my special.
JP the booker over there.
Yeah. We went through sweeping sections of my special, and he was like, okay, maybe if you took this joke here and connected
right.
it to that joke over here. And that's why he was like, I got to hear this to hear if it flows, because we had to cherry pick so much.
Well, that's what you got to do when you long form and you do a short
set. Yeah.
Unless you want to be ballsy and do one bit.
I'd rather do that. I've done that before. Yeah. I did that on the Gotham TV show. I went out and I did one story for 8 minutes, and it...
Yeah.
killed.
Yeah.
And everybody told me, don't do it. If you get stuck in it and they don't like it, you're fucked. And I was like, I'm just doing it. And I did it, and it fucking killed. And it was one of the best TV sets I've ever had in my life.
I did that on John Oliver. It was the first time I committed to a like 11-minute bit.
Right.
And it was great. But I knew there were jokes in it. That's when you start to identify what you do. Is that, like, you know, if you're a long-form guy, and this was, I realized this recently, that you have jokes within it.
Sure,
of course. What keeps it going.
Yeah.
And they're solid. You know, and if you start to look at it as like, well, that piece, that joke needs a little work, or I need something there, whatever.
Absolutely.
Then there's no reason not to have confidence in it if you got your beats right.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think long form, it's funny because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think guys like us would scoff at the joke book, comedy teaching book, whatever textbook approach to comedy, where they say, well, there should be a laugh every 30 seconds. You know, that's the kind of thing that would make a guy like you or me go, oh, fuck you.
Don't well,
fuck
it used it. To. It used to. But like lately, I've sort of like, well, why can't I do that?
Well, that's what I was going to get at is when you start to work in long form and really start to dissect it, you are doing that.
Right.
Because then you go, well, I can't just go on a tirade about murder for 10 minutes. There right. has to be laughs every minute.
Really? Not just a murder tirade?
Yeah. Believe it or not, they don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
don't want to hear that.
You want to punch it up a little.
Yeah, you want to punch up yeah. your murder. Yeah. Your murder bit. His famous murder bit.
Well, I think that, like, I don't know that I had a lot of confidence as a joke writer because I didn't write like that. Like, guys who write jokes, I could tell. You know, he's like working on a never-ending, almost like physics equation of jokes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when he's sitting there doing nothing, he's writing jokes.
Mm-hmm.
He just writes jokes. That's how he. That's what he does.
Yeah.
And they're great.
Yeah.
There's no one better than him at writing jokes.
Right.
But I don't sit there and do that. Like, I never had the discipline to be like, now I'm going to write my jokes. I've never written down a joke in my life. I write lists of things. But the thing is I still envy the joke. But when you're a joke guy, if you're just doing jokes, right, that aren't long-form jokes, you've got to lock into that thing, and that's got to be satisfying to you.
Right.
Like, you know, like to know that, like, I created this little laugh package.
Right.
I will deliver it. That laugh package worked. Like, one after another. You don't have to have a lot of personal investment other than delivering the joke.
Right.
That's got to be satisfying to you. Some guys are like, but and then I had a revelation in the last couple of years. With Shanling, because Shanling reveals a lot about himself in his little jokes,
uh-huh.
and his timing is unlike anything else, and there's a vulnerability to it, and that sort of blew my mind recently, and there's a couple of jokes I'm doing now where I think about Shanling and think about, you know, the joke is, it is enough. It's as much as any piece of poetry could
yeah.
be.
It can't, it, yeah, and it's funny because the last hour, this last hour was all long form. It was like four subjects.
Yeah.
Now I'm finding myself writing much shorter things
yeah.
that have the point quickly, but it doesn't have to be this big global, whatever, you know, politicized,
yeah.
applying to, you know, whatever, tirade.
But it's okay to just be entertaining.
Yeah, and you could still have yourself in that, you know what I mean?
Well, you're probably going to be more yourself in that. That's the when I finally just sort of let go of feeling like I had to make a point and just, like, talk about, you know, my thoughts about things non-aggressively, I'm funnier. Because
right.
then you can be naturally funny.
Right.
You yeah. know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you've been in that position, I'm sure, where you'll say something very honestly on stage and it gets a laugh and you're like, oh, shit, I didn't even realize.
I do that all the time. And then you try to repeat it and it never works again. What? How do I get that moment back? What was it?
Yeah.
What the hell happened there?
It's the hardest thing. Now, do you find... aside from the 4.5 minute sets being tough, I find also sometimes even the 12 minute sets are a little tough. Like, if now you're in a different position than I am because you've made quite a name for yourself.
Yeah, I barely want to do anything anymore.
But like, I find sometimes when I'm going on like at the improv or wherever and you only have 10 minutes, I'm like, I cannot waste 7 minutes on this bit about whatever. I gotta, you know, what if they don't like it? Then I'm gonna be digging myself out of my own hole for 7 minutes.
Well,
know?
I think that eventually you have to get to a point where you don't give a fuck about the 12 minutes. And the thing is that the only thing that changed that for me was making the Comedy Store my home club. I don't bother with the improv. I don't bother, like, I don't give a fuck if anybody in the business sees me and decides that I'm anything.
Right.
I don't care anymore.
Right.
So
when did that happen though?
Um, I guess after, you know, I started to do, once I built my audience,
right,
whatever they are.
Well, there you go.
And I'm going to these clubs really to use them to work out. I want to work out. So I'm going to, you know, it might not work.
Sure.
Like
sure.
At some point you got to look at those sets.
Sure.
As, you know, just, you know, either to try new jokes or to stay in shape, but like to, you know, to do it, you know, only for the audience on a 12-minute set on a showcase night. Nah.
Yeah, no, I think that's the beauty of having an, because I still am in the zone where I'm like, I still need this place. Like, I can't totally go, well,
but
fuck
what, it. But what I'm saying, you know what I mean? Is that eventually, hopefully, you find a comfort in the place to where, you know, it's not, like, you know, I guess they could tell me I can't work there anymore. Maybe they'd be doing me a favor. But I usually, when you're comfortable in a place and you're comfortable in yourself as a funny person, you know, you could be funny if you don't do nothing.
This is my identity problem again. I am comfortable in the place. I've gone off stage there and been beating myself up, and the booker's like, I left. That was great. What do you do?
Yeah, they're lying. You know? They saw how upset you were, and they're just trying to make you feel better.
But, like, they've been so... That's my home. In as far as I'm concerned, in L.A., that's my home. Like, the Improv is where I perform the most, and they're really great to me. And I have no reason whatsoever to ever think they wouldn't continue to support me. But... I still, every time I walk off stage, go, is that going to be the... It's terrible. It's a self-esteem thing.
Well, but you're still putting it on other people. Like, you're saying, like, you know, that's the one that's going to get me less spots.
Right.
What I do is, like, look, I know when something doesn't land. I know when I had to struggle. And I know when it's me and when it isn't.
Right.
And when it is me... like, I just have to reckon with that. But I had to literally train myself to say, like, dude, it's one set, so what? You know, sleep it off.
Right.
As opposed to, like, spend weeks wondering what the fuck happened.
Right.
Or beating the shit out of myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking for a reason to beat the shit out of myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I find other reasons now. I don't have to...
yeah.
Outside like, I keep that in my personal life.
I've gotten much better at not, you know, throwing like a barrage of, you know, whatever at myself afterwards. And I've gotten a lot better at going, stop it. It's one set. It's an evolutionary thing, you know?
But yeah, it is. How long have you been doing it?
15 years.
Yeah.
So not terribly long, but not terribly short.
That's like, long, Joe.
You know,
you're in.
Yeah.
You're a veteran. It's not like... Well, what's longer than that?
I don't know. I saw Louis at a festival in Scotland, and he goes, how long have you been? Because I was like thinking about something. I was like, should I do this or this with my career? And he goes, I was thinking about moving back to New York. And I was like, I don't know, maybe. And he's like, how long have you been doing it? And I go, 15 years. He goes, it's nothing. It's your baby. 20 years. And that's like the Seinfeld thing where he's like, you've only been doing it. You're only as old.
That's crazy.
Whatever that thing is. You're an infant until your comedy age is whatever.
I mean, maybe career-wise, but I mean, 15 years doing something is not nothing.
No, it's not. And I don't think he didn't say it condescendingly like you're nothing.
I know what you mean. He's trying to make you feel better. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, you just got to keep, you know, keep, you're, yeah, ugh, fuck it.
What just happened?
It's just like, you know, like, you know, you've been hammering at it for 15 years. Are you a baby?
Right,
you know what I mean? It's like, there are guys who've been doing it 15 years who were doing great.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like,
there are guys
who've
been doing it 10 years that are doing great.
Yeah, and it's just like, I think you get better.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But, like, let's figure out why the fuck are we so hard on ourselves? I don't know.
I don't know that this is the answer, but my explanation for myself has always been that when you do this type of job, whether it's you're self-employed, okay? Now, look, this when I say this type of job, I mean it could be that you have a contracting landscape business or whatever. But when you say I'm putting it all on me, I'm betting on myself, nothing on anybody else, and my hustle is what's going to put a roof over my head and feed a family one day, you start out organically and with a slave mentality. The audacity that you would ever scoff at a job or not take a job or not swallow wretched abuse
Yeah.
How dare you? It's a slave mentality, really. And I think as you progress through the business, you get better and better at shaking that off and saying, no, I've earned a certain place now for myself, and I am allowed to call certain shots and have certain stipulations for myself. But it's hard, and it's a long journey. And as you know, I think anyone, we all know that, well, we don't all know this, but I know this, and I know you know this. Any one significant event is not going to make or break your career. We're aware of that. But that doesn't mean that anyone...
Unless it's on Twitter.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't mean that any one significant event can't make you feel for a couple days like you're back to square one.
Well, but
you
the weird thing is for me, like, you know, like I didn't make it as a comic first.
What do you mean? Sure, well, you did.
Yeah, I was always around and doing TV and stuff, but I didn't build a draw. So, like, you know, by the time I started this thing, I'm like, you know, I was looking at a life of, you know, headlining B rooms and, you know, maybe, you know, like, it wasn't good, you know, and it wasn't until people got to know me in a bigger way that they would come out, you know, because of the podcast and now the TV show or whatever. But it wasn't just my comedy, you know, it left to my own devices. You know, I was not selling tickets.
Sure, sure. I think a lot of that is just the climate that we're living in right now. It's a different world. It's a different world, and I think.
But you've done some writing.
I have done some writing, and I do
podcasts.
How's
that? You have a podcast?
Yeah, I have two.
Really?
Yeah, I have two. One's about to launch with Kurt Braunohler and myself, called Emotional Hangs on Feral, which is about two grown men exploring the vulnerability of an adult friendship, and like letting the guard down and not doing macho stuff. And you know,
is he married?
He's married now, yeah.
Does he have a kid now?
About to.
Oh, yeah?
His wife's, yeah. I think they're doing like March or something.
Well, that ought to add a little something to the dynamic.
That has, absolutely, yeah. It spiced things up a bit.
Sure.
Yeah, in a good way.
A lot of you going like, I don't know what I'm going to do.
No, that's exactly what we're talking about. Like I've said to him on the podcast, I'm a little jealous of your kid because you're like, you're going to have this kid and I'm not going to get to hang out with you as much, mm-hmm. you know? But I also get it and I'm happy for you. But like, I'd be lying if I didn't say to you, it's weird. Something takes your friend away from you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I have a horror movie podcast called We'll See You in Hell that's already out now. Yeah. It's like a Siskel and Ebert, except about horror
movies. Well, how was the writing experience for you? Because that was something I never even prepared myself at all to write for other people or hang out with other people in that way. Until I did my own show, I found it satisfying.
It's all these things were incremental steps in the greater goal. So it was good for a while. I'm glad I did it. I got a lot of experience out of it for about two and a half years. I wrote for Pete's show for both seasons. I wrote for Wet Hot American Summer, the Netflix series, not the movie.
Oh, yeah?
I wrote for Jeff and Some Aliens, which just premiered on Comedy Central. I wrote for Moshe Kasher's pilot, which was picked up, but the show's not out yet. And so I've written for things. But Moshe's
You were on Breaking Bad, right? Or Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul, yeah. Yeah. So,
you coming back on that one?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's all very secretive.
Did you go to New Mexico to shoot?
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I grew up. Where'd you eat?
Oh, you did?
Over in Albuquerque.
I had this place called Chipotle. It was great.
Oh, good for you.
Really digging
into the local cuisine.
Well, let me tell you something. Every single time I've gone, I've said to somebody, hotel, transport driver, guy at the record store, where can I get some Mexican food? Every time they go, there's a place called Chipotle's right up there. Nobody has once ever said, you gotta go to this place.
Really?
I don't know
why.
Who the
fuck were you talking to? Were they not from there?
I was talking to, the person was wearing a Chipotle t-shirt.
Oh, see.
Maybe they were on break.
Yeah, maybe.
No, I don't know. So, but I, you know.
So you're spreading it out. You got a talent. You're applying in other places. You're earning some money doing that.
Yeah, I directed my special, which was pretty cool. That Comedy Central let me do that.
This one coming out now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's it called?
You Let Me Down.
Hmm.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's a spot on title.
Do you ever find that perhaps, and this is just something I learned with myself, that if you have these unresolved emotional problems and you feel righteous about them, and your sense is that everybody must feel these things,
mm-hmm.
I found that not everybody necessarily does.
Absolutely.
And also, you're not necessarily entertaining them. They might feel a little bad for you.
That does happen. Well, when I bailed out of my TV set last night, the audio, and I went, guys, I'm not doing this. This isn't working, right? And they all went, oh, no.
Come on, Joe.
I was like, no, it's fine, everybody. Just let me just please. I'm just, we'll have fun. Let me just, you know.
So in your mind, given that you're, you know, you obviously seem to be having a bit of a career as a writer and doing these other things, can you surrender to that, or is it still like, nah, stand-up's the thing?
I've been learning that lesson, and it's been affecting the way I approach stand-up. Mm-hmm.
Which lesson?
The lesson you're saying about, like, maybe these problems, maybe every one of your problems isn't relatable. And sometimes it's a long journey up that hill, but, like, I have been open to that. There was a time where I wasn't at all because I was young and naive and stupid. And arrogant, quite frankly. But the older you get, you know, you go, you know, you don't have to open with depression. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's not the thing.
Yeah.
One of the jokes I pitched to Conan.
Yeah.
And I was opening with this in Edinburgh, and then I moved it to the middle, and then it started working when I moved it to the middle of the act.
Yeah.
But I pitched this to Conan thinking this is an appropriate joke for late night TV. I go, I'm 39 years old. The greatest lesson... The greatest realization I've had in 39 years is that it's really stupid when people go, oh, man, if I only knew then what I know now.
Right.
If I knew then what I know now, I would have fucking killed myself. This hasn't been worth the effort at all.
And that one, how's that do?
JP was like, what are you doing? This is right. But it does well in my act.
Right,
But you got to bury it. He's like, you can't walk out and tell the audience you're going to kill yourself.
Right.
But then in my head, I'm like, no, but I'm joking. It's funny.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and then you learn the lesson. Maybe everybody doesn't think that's funny to just throw around, I'm going
to
kill myself.
And maybe we're doing it to get some weird fucking, we're defying them to emotionally engage with us. I mean, because like, maybe that's the problem. Like, I know there's a problem I have is that like, you know, in terms of relationships that like, I'm not great at being as loving as I might want to be. And a lot of times I don't trust when people like me.
Right.
Or love me.
Sure.
So then I push them. Like, you know, sort of, do you love me now? Still? You still love me? Like, you know, I think that, you know, that may be a funny joke, but it also garners a certain amount of sympathy, and that maybe this guy could use a little help. Maybe he needs to be taken care of somehow. Maybe we're looking to the audience as opposed to looking for love. Where, like a lot of guys, they just love to perform for people.
Yes. Yeah. No. And, yeah.
But we're sort of like, you know, I dare you to love me.
I agree with you. I think a lot of comics go on stage like, thank you for letting me perform for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think there are guys like us that go up there and it's more just like, can you just fucking listen for a second? Just God damn it.
I'm in trouble.
Give me a minute. Just hold on.
Trying to get some shit together. I need you to ride this out.
I mean, I can't imagine. I just got anxiety, not a ton, but I got a little bit of an anxiety flutter or whatever you want to call it. When you just said the thing about, do you still love me to the girl?
Yeah.
Because I just, that scares the shit out of me in a relationship.
What?
That I would not be able to get more than 6 or 8 months or a year in, whatever, without constantly being like, am I going to fuck this up? Does she still love me? Did she cheat on me? Is she going to, you know what I mean?
Right. And if you keep talking about that, it does fuck it up.
How long have you been in this one you're in now?
3.5 years.
Oh, Jesus. All right. That's very substantial.
I know.
Well, why do you say it like that?
Because I feel like a lot of times I'm spinning my wheels, you know, like I still am not getting to that level where, you know, I'm open and everything's great. And, you know what I mean?
So that's disappointment in yourself when you go, I know.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's like, and I'm getting to an age where I don't know if I can fix it or if I want to fix it, because the effort to, you know, to fix it becomes this whole other thing.
Sure.
Like, I guess it's surrendering to cynicism.
Look, you know, I will say this, Mark, and this is not me trying to give you some sort of a pass, and I might be really wrong.
Yeah.
But I might be right.
Yeah.
I think sometimes all it comes down to is two people being compatible. You know, yeah. It's like if you were, if you witnessed a relationship where the couple literally fist fought one another.
Yeah.
And then you said, that's not healthy. And you went over to them and you were like, hey, guys. And they were like, get the fuck away. This is what we fucking do. You'd right. be like, hey, guys, I guess if that makes you happy, like fist fight each other. I don't know if that's what's working for you and you'll grow to be 95 years old together. Then, hey, God bless. I don't know.
I guess. But then there's the issue of like, you know, what if they could get past those obstacles that would make that seem like love to them? To where they wouldn't keep attracting, you know, people that would do that with them, and they could experience something different.
But I'm saying, what if they didn't need to?
No one needs to.
But nobody needs to.
Right.
But I'm saying sometimes I was just talking yesterday.
I know what you're saying. Life is short. Maybe this is what you got.
Well, it's like the thing in Annie Hall where he walks up to the couple and he goes, I don't understand. How do you do it? How are you a happy couple? We're both superficial. We don't ask a lot of questions.
Right.
Hey, if that works for you,
right.
great. If Kanye and Kim Kardashian works for them, great.
Right.
Enjoy yourselves. You know, I think we have a habit as people to always, and I'm not saying there's no such thing as bad behavior or toxic behavior or abusive behavior. Or anything. That's not what I mean.
Yeah.
But I do think as people, we always think it's almost an ego thing. We've got to like get to this deeper thing so it's more of an exploration. And it's like, sometimes it's just not that, man. Sometimes it's just, hey, my wife and I don't talk, but we love each other and she's fine with that. And I'm fine with that. That's okay.
Uh-huh.
Our best friends, they talk all the time. Good for them.
Yeah.
We don't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, I guess it's okay if you're not sitting there every day going like, why don't I talk?
Well, but here's the thing. You're saying that, but my point is if you're not talking and that's sort of your natural thing and your lady isn't going, why aren't you fucking talking?
Yeah.
Then there's no problem. If she's like, Mark, I don't care. I love you. You don't talk. I don't care.
Yeah, but sometimes like the dynamic that you find yourself in for years is them going, why aren't you talking?
Well, then that's
where, not the dynamic I have, but that's what I'm saying.
That's when it's a problem. And that's when it's either I have to figure out how to change this or this person isn't right for me.
Yeah.
Then you find the person that goes, I don't care that you don't talk. Never talk to me. I love you. You know what I mean? And they mean it. And you go, oh,
you'll
sure.
find something wrong with that.
Huh?
You'll find something wrong with that.
I'll find something wrong with everything.
Yeah.
I have a problem with what I'm saying right now. So
are you dating anyone?
Probably not after this podcast. No, nobody serious. I'm trying to, I'm very actively trying to have less flingy situations in my life, and I really do want to substantially or date somebody and have a substantial thing. So it's not to say that I'm above anything lesser than that, but I'm trying to do that. I'd like to find somebody I can really spend some time with.
Okay, well, I don't have time, or I would try, but I just
thank
don't.
You.
Yeah,
yeah.
But so when's the special premiere?
February 3rd on Comedy Central at midnight. Second play is February 5th. 1 a.m. is the replay, and then those are both uncensored. And then the record and, you know, where you can download the special,
yeah.
February 7th. It'll start streaming, I think, on the 3rd.
All right.
You know what I mean.
A lot of numbers.
Yeah, I don't know. Just
you'll be all right.
Thank you for having me.
Nice seeing you.
This was really, really lovely.
Thank you, buddy.
I mean it.
I'm glad we did it.
I'm really glad we did it. I'd like to just start coming over here and just kind of, you know.
All right. Well, you know, text me first.
I'll just, you know, no, just some days you open the garage door, I'm in here.
No, don't mind me. I'm just going to sit over here.
And I have coffee. Yeah, Mark, yeah. Mark. Yeah.
I know. I believe you.
I promise I won't do that.
All right, buddy.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. That's it. That's me and Joe. I'll be talking in real time-ish, or at least the night before next week when I'm back. I hope everyone's hanging in. I think I will. I'll play a little guitar. Just some hard rock. Probably redundant, but I'll do it. Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.